Today, the Oblivion Factor. The DFA Daily is the 24th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today we look at the latest attempts to bribe first-time buyers, the latest auction clearance results, and the swathe of data from the US as yet more support is passed into law, yet the virus still rages. The Australian said Australia's biggest banks have been stymieing businesses attempting to gain bridging finance for wages before the $130 billion JobKeeper payments begins next month, prompting Scott Morrison to order them to be read the Riot Act. The Australian understands the banks buckled to demands to lift their game after a furious Prime Minister vented his anger about the Big Four during a phone hookup with Tax Commissioner Jordan and Frydenberg early on Thursday. In a sign that the industry was rushing to catch up, the usual communications from big banks and the Australian Banking Association took until late afternoon or early evening to emerge, a couple of them confirming the key charge against the banking industry. Banks have already granted more than $700 million worth of loans to businesses to help them get through the crisis, the ABA wrote in their media release. Come again? Only $700 million? Surely this number would have been eight figures by now, or even nine, but no, apparently not. Commonwealth Bank said that to date, we have approved more than $340 million in loans for thousands of small businesses so they can stay open for business, hibernate through the shutdown, and retain staff. Almost 80% of these loans are for businesses eligible for the JobKeeper program, so small businesses can avoid the need to terminate staff. These are unsecured loans of up to $250,000 at historically low rates. But Banking Day was able to clarify the CBA loan volume numbers that they began from the 20th of March, while the scope of the ABA's estimate for the whole industry is frankly vague. The ABA media release from this time bragged the small business relief package will apply to more than $100 million of existing small business loans and, depending on customer take-up, could put as much as $8 billion back into the pockets of small businesses as they battle through these difficult times. ANZ, in a statement, shared a couple of data points but nothing on loan volumes. ANZ has already provided more than 6,300 SME customers with a 10% increase in their overdrafts, which has helped alleviate some of the financial pressure and provided support until JobKeeper payments arrive, the bank said. ANZ has also provided loan repayment deferrals to about 15% of its SME customers. Are these tepid industry numbers on crisis loans a function of surprisingly lame demand from business for credit and credit relief, or a function of latent distrust of the industry, or, most likely, the product of an overwhelmed banking elite being gifted a golden opportunity to blow off as much as the industry possibly could of all the odour from the Banking Royal Commission and then monumentally mess things up? We are pretty much in the dark about the risks of individual banks in Australia. Apart from their individual public disclosures, there is little else out there, unlike the New Zealand Reserve Bank, which has a scorecard for each bank in the context of their warnings. Depositors should do their own due diligence on individual lenders. But Moody's says, as a result of weakening economic activity and rising unemployment, bank loan defaults will increase, although the ultimate impact will depend on the breadth and severity of the disruption, as well as on the effectiveness of the large stimulus measures provided by the Australian government to support domestic companies and consumption. Increasing loan loss provisioning, record low interest rates, and strong price competition amidst low loan growth will hurt banks' profitability. Moody's consequently expects internal capital generation to weaken, especially at smaller banks, eroding their current strong buffers against loan losses. Bank funding and liquidity conditions remain supported by the Reserve Bank of Australia, monetary measures, including government bond purchases and a funding facility to support credit intermediation and long-term repo activity, as well as by reduced consumption, which is contributing to an increase in deposits. However, wholesale funding stability could be tested if the virus outbreak persists, with wholesale funding generally more price and confidence sensitive. Among rated Australian banks, Moody's anticipates greater negative rating implications for those with a direct exposure to the most negatively affected sectors of the economy and for those banks with relatively narrow financial buffers compared to expectations for their current ratings. These include, in particular, banks with relatively low levels of core capital compared to the forward-looking risks of their asset quality and/or a higher exposure to wholesale funding markets. The four banks affected by today's rating actions fall into this group. Qudos Bank has a strong franchise among aviation sector employees, which comprise approximately a third of mortgage borrowers and contribute 15% of deposits. The aviation sector has been heavily affected by the virus outbreak, given extensive travel restrictions and reduced consumer demand. Extensive layoffs in the sector and the potential for the drawn-out recovery of demand for passenger flights expose the bank's asset quality and earnings to meaningful pressure. MyState is less well capitalised than many of its Baa1 rated residential mortgage focused peers, but its asset quality as measured by problem loans as a percentage of gross loans is stronger at 0.2% as at the fiscal year 2019. At the same time, Moody's expects economic disruption stemming from the virus to weigh on the asset quality outlook, and the bank has a loan exposure concentration in Tasmania, although it has been expanding into mainland Australia through brokers. Wholesale funding comprises around 30% of total funding, but the majority is in the form of securitisation, reducing the mismatch between assets and liabilities and short-term funding risk. The bank also intends to increase the share of retail deposits over the longer term. Similarly, IMB Limited's core capital is weaker than the peer average at 12.6% as at December 2019, but its problem loan ratio is stronger at 0.1%. Capital flexibility remains supported by the bank's mutual model and by its ability to defer legacy ordinary share buybacks and dividend payments, offsetting profitability pressure. At the same time, asset quality is likely to come under pressure amid the virus outbreak, while the bank has a regionally concentrated franchise in New South Wales. Wholesale funding comprises around 30% of total funding, although around two-thirds of this consists of deposits from councils, universities, government agencies, and superannuation funds that exhibit greater stability than most wholesale sources. And ME Bank's capitalisation is at the lower end of the Baa1 peer group, even after taking into account the pre-committed capital support from its shareholders, which are large superannuation funds. The bank's non-performing loan ratio is also higher than for some of its peers. Nonetheless, the bank's key shareholders have a large capacity to provide further capital support if required. The bank has a high proportion of wholesale funding at around 40%, although half of this is in the form of securitisation, while the remainder is diversified across channels and investors. The bank's relationship with large superannuation funds has supported deposits, even as the Australian government has allowed people affected by the virus outbreak to access their superannuation savings early. The bank is also striving to increase the share of retail deposits in its funding mix over the longer term. The Victorian government has announced that it is extending its first home owner grant for an additional 12 months to support home buyers. Victorian Treasurer Tim Pallas said the state government would be extending the $20,000 first home owner grant for people buying or building a new home in regional Victoria for another 12 months. The regional grant, which had been due to end in June, will be extended until the middle of 2021. According to Mr. Pallas, the extensions will provide certainty to the regional construction industry as the state deals with the economic impact of the virus, while also providing Victorians with the opportunity to live locally and enter the housing market for the first time. We know the virus is making it even tougher for young people to achieve their dreams of home ownership. That's why we're extending the grant, which has helped so many regional Victorians, Mr. Pallas said. The change will be included in legislation that the government is looking to pass into the emergency sitting of Parliament this week. And in 2017, the Labour government in Victoria doubled the regional home grant from $10,000 to $20,000 to tackle housing affordability. Since then, more than 8,800 regional grants have been provided, which have resulted in savings of $176 million for home buyers. The regional grant is part of the government's Homes for Victorians package, which also offers a $10,000 grant for eligible purchases in metropolitan Melbourne and offers stamp duty exemptions and discounts for new homes up to $750,000. To be eligible for the grant, the purchaser or purchasers must be first home buyers or building a property valued at $750,000 or less, and it must be used as a principal place of residence for 12 months continuous following settlement. And the grant is available for first home purchases across 48 councils. But of course, such grants as these lifts prices and distorts the market. But as I said yesterday, expect more of these unnatural acts to try and keep home prices up. CoreLogic says last week, a total of 1,922 homes were scheduled to go to auction across the combined capital cities, returning a final auction clearance rate of 30.2%, once again surpassing the previous week as the lowest on record for CoreLogic. Of the 440 properties reported as being sold across the capital cities, 60.9% sold prior to the scheduled auction date, and of the 1,444 results collected, more than half, 56%, were withdrawn. And they have also alerted us to the possibility that they will be withdrawing their daily index due to the low volumes of transactions. And as I said in a recent tweet, in case of emergency, break glass. And more broadly, Fitch Ratings has made further large cuts to global GDP forecasts in its latest global economic outlook in response to virus-related lockdown extensions and income data flows. World GDP is now expected to fall by 3.9% in 2020, a recession of unprecedented depth in the post-war period, they say. This is twice as large as the decline anticipated in our early April update and would be twice as severe as the 2009 recession. The decline in GDP equates to a $2.8 trillion fall in global income levels relative to 2019 and a loss of $4.5 trillion relative to their previous pre-virus expectation of 2020 global GDP. Fitch expects Eurozone GDP to decline by 7%, US GDP by 5.6%, and UK GDP by 6.3% in 2020. The biggest downward revisions are in the Eurozone, where the measures to halt the spread of the virus have already taken a very heavy toll on activity in the first quarter 2020. They cut Italy's forecast to minus 8% following official indications that GDP had already fallen 5% in the first quarter 2020, and after a recent extension of the lockdown there. Official estimates also point to France and Spain experiencing near 5% declines in GDP in the first quarter 2020, with the Spanish outlook hit particularly hard by the collapse in tourism. Even allowing for a slightly less negative outlook for Germany, where the headroom for policy easing is greater and the benefits of recovery in China will be more felt directly, Eurozone GDP is expected to shrink by 7% this year. And they conclude no country or region has been spared from the devastating economic impact of the global pandemic, and we now anticipate that GDP in both the US and the UK, where lockdown started a little later than in the Eurozone, will decline by more than 10%, not annualised, in the second quarter of 2020, compared to forecasts of around 7% in the April update. This will result in annual GDP declines of around 6% despite aggressive macro policy easing. And in addition, incoming data, including official flash GDP estimates for the first quarter 2020, monthly activity indicators for March and weekly labour data market all point to daily losses of activity through lockdown episodes of closer to 25% than the previous 20% assumed. This is consistent with the recent release outturn for growth in China, when GDP declined by 10% quarter over quarter in the first quarter 2020, a period encompassing entry to and exit from a five-week lockdown. Macro policy responses have been unprecedented scale and scope and will serve to cushion the near-term shock, but with job losses occurring on an extreme scale and intense pressures on small and medium-sized businesses, the path back to normality after the health crisis subsides is likely to be slow. Their forecasts now show US and Eurozone GDP remaining below pre-virus levels through the whole of 2021. And there were several important developments in the US overnight. To facilitate lending to small businesses via the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP, the Federal Reserve on Thursday announced that it was working to expand access to its Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, the PPPLF, for additional SBA-qualified lenders as soon as possible. SBA-qualified PPP lenders include depository institutions such as banks and credit unions, as well as non-depository institution lenders such as some community development financial institutions. Currently, only depository institutions are eligible to participate in the PPPLF, and over 1,000 have already been approved to access the program. The SBA's PPP guarantee loans from qualified lenders to small businesses so that these businesses can keep workers employed. And the PPPLF supports the PPP by extending credit to financial institutions that make PPP loans, using the loans as collateral. And the additional liquidity from the PPPLF increases the capacity of financial institutions to make additional PPP loans. And additional details on eligibility will be announced shortly. PPP, PPPP, PP. Do you get the message? And the House voted on Thursday overwhelmingly to pass legislation providing roughly $484 billion US in relief for small businesses, hospitals and expanding medical testing, capping weeks of contentious negotiations that had stalled Washington's latest round of emergency aid. The legislation, which the Senate passed unanimously on Tuesday, now goes to the desk of President Trump, who has promised to sign it quickly into law. The massive package is the fourth coronavirus bill to move through Congress over the last 7 weeks and brings the federal response to the global pandemic up to a whopping $2.8 trillion, by far the largest emergency relief effort in modern US history. Central to the massive relief package is $310 billion to replenish the Paycheck Protection Program, that PPP again, a new and wildly popular initiative that provides forgivable loans to small businesses devastated by the pandemic. Congress had allocated an additional $349 billion to the PPP in the last relief bill, a $2.2 trillion package enacted on March the 27th, only to see the funds run dry shortly afterwards due to the rush of businesses seeking to tap the benefits. The package earmarks $60 billion for community banks and smaller lenders who tend to cater for those underserved businesses, while providing an additional $60 billion for emergency business grants and loans. And Democrats also secured an additional $75 billion for hospitals and community health centers and another $25 billion to boost COVID-19 testing. And Bloomberg says that the tidal waves of unemployment filings across the U.S. showed only the barest signs of abating last week, as more than 4 million people applied for benefits, bringing the five-week total during the virus pandemic to 26.5 million. Most states continue to see initial claims decline on an unadjusted basis, and several states did report decreases in layoffs for the prior week, both signs that job losses are indeed slowing a bit. And government aid to small businesses could spur more employers to restore jobs in coming months, but filings might continue at an extraordinary pace for several more weeks, boosting an unemployment rate that already may be around 20%. Whilst most of the layoffs in sectors like retail have already occurred, there will be collateral damage as companies faced with weak demand dismiss workers, says Jay Bryson, acting chief economist at Wells Fargo. Bryson said, he believes the US is past the peak in initial claims for the foreseeable future. But if we open up too soon and this virus comes roaring back, then we may in fact see this sort of numbers again. It's still unclear to what extent the most recent claims totals reflect millions of people still losing their jobs each week, or whether it's largely a reflection of jobless Americans who are just now able to get through jammed websites and phone lines after weeks of trying. States are racing to boost the capacity to computer systems built years ago, adding workers to handle unprecedented volumes of claims, and trying to get the $600 in additional weekly aid to the unemployed. Some states have taken steps such as staggering applications by alphabetical order of last name or the last digit of one's social security number on certain days of the week in order to manage the flow. Initial jobless claims of 4.43 million in the week ended 18th of April followed a slightly downwardly revised 5.24 million in the prior week, according to Labour Department figures on Thursday, and the median estimate of economists was for 4.5 million claims. California reported the most initial claims last week at an unadjusted 533,600, down from 655,500 the prior week. Florida was next, followed by Texas at 280,400, up slightly from the prior week. Georgia and New York also reported more than 200,000 filings, though both were down from the previous week. Unadjusted claims in Florida more than doubled from the prior week to an estimated 505,000. Connecticut and West Virginia also posted sharp increases, And US stocks rose after the report, while 10-year Treasury yields were little changed. Assuming all who file for benefits are counted as unemployed, the latest figures suggest a potential April unemployment rate of around 20%, given that Thursday's data reflects the reference week for the monthly job report. That's double the 10% peak reached in the wake of the last recession in 2009 and approaching the levels last seen during the Great Recession. And finally, a New York study seeking to measure the spread of the new coronavirus found that 13.9% of 3,000 people tested across the state had signs of the virus, one of the biggest U.S. reviews to date. That implies that about 2.7 million residents may have had the virus, Governor Andrew Cuomo said. That's about 10 times more than the official count based on the state's testing, which covered mostly very sick patients. The pandemic was more intense in New York City, the hardest hit area in the US, where 21.2% of people tested positive for a blood marker, showing that they'd been infected at some point. "We're going to continue this testing on a rolling basis," he said. "We'll have a larger and larger sample. But I want to see snapshots of what is happening with that rate. Is it going up? Is it flat? Is it going down? And it can really give us data to make decisions." The preliminary results appear to confirm predictions that the virus has infected far more people than New York has been able to diagnose. It also means that the fatality rate is likely lower than implied by merely examining confirmed cases and deaths. If 2.7 million people have been infected, that would put the fatality rate at around 0.5% based on the death count of 15,500 the state used to make its calculation. Since then, the number of deaths in New York has risen to 15,740. The current death count doesn't include some people who may have died at home and weren't diagnosed, and may also miss people who died earlier in the outbreak before diagnostic testing became widespread. The survey used blood tests that look for antibodies, which are markers in the blood created by the immune system after a person has been infected. They can show whether a person was previously infected by the virus even after they've recovered from the illness. Antibody tests may also help find people who were infected but showed few or no symptoms. Diagnostic tests such as the nasal swabs used on people who show up sick in the hospital check for the virus itself. They can't find out whether people were previously infected and recovered. However, antibody testing took samples from 40 locations in 19 counties from people over the age of 18 who were shopping at grocery and big box stores. The weighted results showed more than 1 in 5 New Yorkers tested positive, as well as 16.7% of those in Long Island and 11.7% of those in Westchester and Rockland counties. The estimate showed 3.6% tested positive in the rest of the state, and positive tests were highest amongst multiracial people at 22.8%, along with African Americans and Latinos, both around 22%. New York has been focused on increasing testing for the virus and antibodies, and the federal government has agreed to help double capacity to 40,000 tests per day. So once again, this highlights how little we know about the virus. And of course, if the infection rates are really that high, it does change the landscape somewhat. Although locally in Australia, it does appear as though at the moment the virus is much more contained than in New York. So the key takeout from today is once again just how serious the economic consequences are of what's happening with the economic slowdown. And unfortunately, we have to recognise once again that this is not going to get fixed quickly, which means that the economic consequences will probably be even more severe than those currently forecast. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.